I'm Matt Katz from WNYC, in for Melissa Harris-Perry this week, and this is The Takeaway. The jury is out in the trial of Kimberly Potter. The former Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer faces manslaughter charges after she shot and killed Dante Wright in April. As evidenced by body cam footage from the scene and trial testimony, she meant to draw and discharge her taser, not her gun.
I don't know what's happening.
As with the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in February and George Floyd in May, people across the country responded to Wright's death with protest.
Say his name! Dante Wright! Say his name! Dante Wright! Say it now! Justice! Justice!
In closing arguments on Monday, Assistant Minnesota Attorney General Erin Eldridge put the case in stark and simple terms.
It's a case about the defendant's reckless handling of her firearm, and it's about her culpable negligence. She knew she had a loaded gun on her duty belt. She carried it on the right side every day for 26 years. And that's the weapon she used. All that training and all that experience shows that she was aware of the risks associated with her weapons.
During the trial, prosecutors attempted to illustrate the proper and safe handling of tasers. They had Brooklyn Center Police Sergeant Mike Peterson demonstrate the series of steps meant to come before the weapon is used.
I carry my taser on my left side, and now I simply press my arc switch again. It runs through a 5-second spark test.
Defense attorney Earl Gray responded in his closing statement, saying these claims were a catch-22.
She didn't do the spark test, so that's evidence of recklessness. They also used the fact that she went to each and every training session. They're using that to say she's reckless. Can you imagine if she didn't go? They would call her criminal, reckless.
Each side took time to address Dante Wright's actions as well. They addressed the claim from fellow officer Sergeant Johnson, who was with Potter on the scene, that Wright would have dragged him with his car had he not been shot.
He posed no threat to those officers.
No threat by Dante Wright? He broke free from a law enforcement officer and took off in his car even after he was shot. No threat.
A lot of questions, far fewer answers. Let's talk about it. With me now to discuss the details of the trial as we await a verdict is Associated Press reporter Amy Forlitti. Welcome to The Takeaway, Amy. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for having me.
So both sides in this case refer to the killing as accidental, but how did they go about proving whether or not it's a crime?
Sure. Well, the judge has said all along, and both sides agree, that intent is not part of this. The prosecutors do not have to prove that Kim Potter intended to shoot and kill Dante Wright. The elements, she's charged with first-degree manslaughter and second-degree manslaughter. And for first-degree manslaughter, prosecutors have to prove that she caused Wright's death while committing the crime of reckless handling of a firearm. Mm-hmm. That means they have to prove that she committed a conscious or intentional act while using the firearm that created a substantial risk that she was aware of. For second degree manslaughter, they have to prove she acted with culpable negligence, meaning she consciously took a chance of causing a death or great bodily harm. The defense is saying it was a mistake and that she wasn't acting reckless and she wasn't consciously taking a chance of causing death.
So there's two different questions for the jury to really decide on here?
Yes, they have to sort their way through both of the charges. For, like I said, manslaughter one requires that element of recklessness, and then manslaughter two is culpable negligence. And they'll have to work through the jury verdict form and come to a conclusion.
Got it. So how easy is it for an officer to mix up their taser and their gun? And do you know how common it is?
It does not happen that much. Some of my colleagues have done some reporting on this and found that maybe once a year is when something like this happens. Officers are trained. They know they carry their firearm on the opposite side of their duty belt as their taser. They go through training. They can choose how they want to position their taser so they can draw it in a way that's most comfortable or easiest for them to do it. And they go through training every year. They're also warned on the dangers of possibly mixing them up. And that's something prosecutors are really hammering in on. They're saying that Kim Potter attended all of these trainings. She knew the warnings and she knew the risks.
Of course, it in the moment is a whole different situation than training, which I'm sure is part of what the defense is arguing?
Absolutely. The defense is saying that this was what they called an action error. They had an expert testify about these so-called action errors that they say everyone does. It's similar to at the start of the year writing the previous year's date on the right top of your check. And they say that it's this one expert who testified said that sometimes the training that you've had all along just overtakes newer training. And she had been trained in longer on using her gun. And perhaps that overtook the training of the taser in that heat of the moment. And she just did, her brain just kind of took over and she was unconscious that it happened.
Tell me about Kimberly Potter's own testimony here and how that might factor into the jury's decision.
Well, her testimony was quite emotional. She did apologize. She said she was sorry this happened. She didn't mean to hurt anyone. She also said that she wouldn't have pulled Dante Wright over for the hanging air freshener from his rearview mirror and for his expired license tags, because she said this. In this case where we're dealing with COVID, a lot of people are behind on renewing their license tags. And this wasn't something she would have even pulled him over for, but she was training another officer. He wanted to do the pullover. She let him do it because it was important for the other officer to have interaction with the public. And then she started talking about how the arrest was just chaotic. Once they realized Dante Wright had a warrant out for his arrest for weapons possession violation, he struggled, he resisted, he got back in his car, and she said that things just went chaotic.
Wow. And then she shot him, and then what happened? What was her reaction? Can you characterize how Kimberly Potter handled herself after shooting this individual?
Yes. Well, let me say that she testified that when she pulled out, or she thought she was pulling out her taser after she saw fear in another officer's face, and she shouted a taser warning. And then after that, she says she doesn't remember what happened. So she testified that she doesn't remember her reaction that day, but body camera video shows, and you played some of this at the start of the show, that she was just distraught. She crumpled on the ground. She started shouting, oh my God, I killed a boy. I'm going to prison. She was inconsolable in that moment.
Wow. There was also testimony from Dante Wright's mother, who was actually on the phone with him just before the killing. Did that conversation give the jury some insight into Wright's mindset and his potential intentions right before the confrontation that led to his death?
You know, perhaps a little bit. It sounds like Katie Bryant, his mother, testified that he called her right after he was pulled over and said, I just got pulled over for an air freshener. And she became very emotional on the stand too, because as a mother, she told him, don't worry about it, it's going to be okay. And she said that he set the phone down and she heard the officer tell him to get out of the car. But then she also heard someone say to hang up the phone, and his passenger then hung up the phone. So she didn't hear anything else after that. And once, she tried to call him back repeatedly, ended up doing a video call, which the passenger, Dante Wright's girlfriend, answered. And that testimony got very emotional because that was when Katie Bryant learned her son had been shot. The girlfriend told his mother this and then turned the cell phone video camera toward her son's body, and she saw him in the car.
Amy, the jury is now considering this. Can you tell me a little bit about the jury and the jury selection process? How did the larger national conversation on police killings and Black Lives Matter factor into the jury selection process?
Sure. You know, the larger conversation hasn't been a part of the trial at all, but it was a part of jury selection. And jurors were asked individually what their views are on Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, if they believe Black people are treated differently in the criminal justice system when compared with white people. They were asked a whole host of questions about race. They were asked if they participated in protests, if they carried signs in protests, and that sort of thing. And what we learned during jury selection is many of the people who had extreme biases one way or the other and said that they could not change their views and view the case fairly based on the evidence that would be presented at trial, they were ultimately dismissed. And so the jurors who are hearing the case now, while they may have had some views, they all said that they could put aside their views and just listen to the evidence, just listen to what was happening in court and weigh the facts.
And the racial makeup of the jury?
The jury is mostly white. There are, I believe, nine white people on the jury. Two members of the jury are Asian, and there is one Black woman on the jury. So it is a predominantly white jury.
You know, Amy, you cover crime in courts. You've heard these emotional testimonies from the stand. Do you expect that emotion to impact the jury's decision?
Well, it's something that the jury heard, definitely, and and they were very attentive during that testimony. And, you know, they also saw body camera footage of Dante Wright's body being pulled from the vehicle and life-saving efforts that were done. And so you would think that would have to have some sort of impact as they're considering the case.
Yeah.
However, the judge gave them strict instructions that sympathies and any emotions they might be feeling toward any of the witnesses or the victims, that's not evidence. And they need to decide the case based on the evidence and the facts that were presented.
Amy, just a couple seconds left, but can you tell me if any protests are expected following this verdict?
It's hard to say. We don't know of any that are planned right now. We do know of a news conference that's planned after the verdict comes down, but we don't know what to expect. I know that the city is anticipating that possibility, but we'll just have to see what happens.
I've been speaking with Amy Forlitti, who covers crime and courts for the Associated Press. Amy, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. A few of you may know this. At the beginning of my journalism career, I had a nationally syndicated dating column based out of the Courier-Post in New Jersey. The dating column was called The Bachelor Pad, and I was sometimes called South Jersey's very own Carrie Bradshaw. And just like that, 13 years of marriage and two kids later, I'm now a reporter at WNYC, and whenever I fill in here as a host on The Takeaway, the producers like to take me back to my Sex and the City days. So I couldn't help but wonder, how have relationships, love, and dating changed nearly 2 years into this pandemic? Just a heads up to listeners, this is a conversation about relationships and love, and that includes references to sex. Since I'm long out of the dating column game, I turned to Dr. Lex Brown James, a licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy, and Logan Urey, author of the book How to Not Die Alone and director of relationship science at Hinge. The pandemic has brought major changes to just about every part of our lives, so I asked Dr. Lex about it.
We've seen a rise in divorce rates. People have decided that you are not the person I want to be in quarantine with. I didn't know all of this about you. And they're either deciding to leave their relationships or they're deciding to really hunker down and stay together and do the work that they need to do to be happy in relationships.
You know, I've certainly seen that in my own circle, early 40s, young, but not super young kids. And I've just seen a wave of pandemic divorces. Are some relationships, by contrast, possibly getting stronger? Have you seen any evidence of that?
Oh, absolutely, Matt. I have been booked and busy since March of 2020. So I had to force myself to take a vacation, and many other relationship therapists are in the same boat, where we've seen a huge return to therapy, even for people who are traditionally not on board for therapy, some more marginalized communities. Uh-huh. People of lower socioeconomic status have actually sought out more help for their relationships specifically to try and figure out how to make things work and how to make things work specifically for them.
And that's been successful. You've seen successes in dealing with some of these couples.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've graduated some couples. My oldest couple was 86 and 92 that graduated from therapy, and really finding what true intimacy is and ways to build vulnerability and to trust one another in a world where we're seeing so much more of our lover.
Yeah.
And it's really come full circle where people can fall back in love again.
How long was that couple married for or together for?
Most interestingly, they actually met in high school and then married other people and came back together later in life. And so they've been spending, I think, the last maybe 8 years and are continuing on in all sorts of relationship bliss.
That's totally fascinating. We got to get them on The Takeaway. Amazing. And coming to you, Logan, for those who are single or dating right now, how has dating changed through the pandemic? What sorts of trends have you seen over the last almost 2 years? Like, I know Zoom and video dates are a big thing, and I don't know if that's still the case. What are you seeing out there?
Yes, you're exactly right. So coincidentally, I started my role at Hinge the week that the pandemic really exploded in New York. So I've had, one could say, the honor, privilege, or challenge of tracking the pandemic's impact on dating over the last 2 years. And there's been some really distinct phases. So the first phase was that people really went inside. They did a lot of internal thinking. They were home alone, and people got really introspective. After leading these very busy lives, people took a pause and said, wait, there's a pandemic? What am I doing with my life? Why am I single? What's holding me back? What are my patterns? And we saw this huge shift in people really becoming more introspective, thinking about who they were and what they wanted. Mm. And we saw right away that people weren't willing to pause their dating. In fact, in March of 2020, we saw 30% more matches and 30% more messages than we did the previous March.
Wow. Wow. And how have things changed? Like, what is dating like at this moment?
Yeah. So after that introspection stage, people started video dating. And that was something that barely anyone had done before the pandemic. It might have been something that you did with a long-term partner when you were in a long-distance relationship or if somebody was out of town, but it wasn't really this first date or second date. And then we found that 45% of Hinge users had been on a video date within the first 6 months of the pandemic. So that was a major change. And that's still going on. People tell us that video dates are this safe and efficient way to get a vibe check, to say, do I like the way you look? Do I like the sound of your voice? Do we have something that we can talk about? And so video dating is one of those cultural shifts that came because of the pandemic and is here to stay.
So that hasn't subsided as the pandemic has worn on. People aren't like, I've been on Zoom all day for work. I'm not going to do a happy hour date on Zoom again now. You're still seeing it.
That's one interesting thing that I work on with my dating coaching clients, is helping them make that shift. If you have a work meeting that ends at 5 and then you have a video date that starts at 5, you should not be going from one Zoom meeting to the next. What can you do to actually shift your mindset and say, okay, I'm going to be in a new mental space. I'm going to put on perfume. I'm going to change my lighting. It has been really hard for people not to date like a job interview when they're doing it over Zoom. But yes, we do see people continuing to video date, especially even in the last few weeks with the new variant. People have adopted this habit of, okay, when it feels unsafe to date, one thing that I can rely on is video date. That being said, there has been a huge increase in audio as well. I'm sure you're familiar with the app Clubhouse, and that really made a dent in the first year of the pandemic. And now we're seeing that happen with Hinge, where we just added these Hinge voice prompts and people are having so much fun with them. They're making TikTok compilations. And so anecdotally, I'm seeing that people are experiencing some Zoom fatigue right now at the end of the year. And I'm personally hearing about more phone calls than video calls because I think people are just a little bit tired of video.
Sure, sure. Makes sense. And one more question for you, Logan, regarding meeting somebody online and then dating. You've got a date set. You've been either voice calling or video calling with this person. So you schedule a date. You're excited to meet. When do you ask about, you know, vax status?
Yeah, that's been the question ever since the vaccine came out. So earlier this year, Hinge put the ability to say your vaccination status on your profile. And I actually had the opportunity to interview the Surgeon General about this, and he had some really good tips. And he said that, you know, you can just model the behavior that you want to see in the other person. So you can say, hey, I'm really looking forward to meeting up. By the way, I'm vaccinated, I'm boosted, and I live with my elderly parents. I would prefer if we wear masks for our first date. What about you? What are you comfortable with? Mm-hmm. And I really like that because you're not starting with an interrogation or a demand. You're saying, here's my situation. Here's my request. What about you? And I think it gives the other person a chance to be honest and to ask for what they need.
Dr. Lex, let's say, you know, we're dating, we're in a relationship, we're in a marriage, and this prolonged pandemic has made us overwhelmed, overstressed. We just don't have the space and time for the intimacy like we used to. What do we do?
Oh my goodness. That is absolutely happening. We find that numbers regarding any type of intercourse are actually down. So people always think the younger generations are just horny and ready to go. And it's actually been statistically shown that they're having less sex than ever now. Mm-hmm. And that's also translating over specifically into millennials. And people have to remember, millennials are 35 and early 40s now. They're not still 18 and 21. And so intimacy is going to wax and wane. That is absolutely true. What I love for people to do is, one, is to get in some solo time. Every experience doesn't have to be partnered. It's also not a sign of a rejection of your partner. It can be a lot of responsibility and a lot of anxiety lifted from this idea that we have that really should not be owned by one person, that you're supposed to please your partner. It really is about centering your pleasure and then having your partner help you facilitate your pleasure. And that goes both ways or all ways, depending on how many partners you have. And then same for folks with dating, right? So I love that idea of modeling, but because there has been COVID even found in semen, although there hasn't been sexually transmitted infections attributed to COVID in semen as of yet, the level of protectability is also something that really hinges with pleasure. So am I being safe? Am I feeling safer? Those things, once the answer is yes, actually increase pleasure. And last but not least, schedule it. People really don't like this idea because, I don't know, everything is supposed to be really spontaneous, right? And you're supposed to just like walk in the house and take off your clothes and, you know, go for it. And I'm like, who has time for that nowadays? There are people at home. So you say, hey, we would really like some house time. Can you all go for a walk around this time? Can somebody take the kids to the park? And you schedule it. If you have a family calendar, you put it in a code so nobody else discerns your code. Wow. And it gives you and your lover something to look forward to and a specific time that you all have planned out for some togetherhood.
So schedule it like a set day and time every week or so, or just like look at your calendar at the beginning of the week and see where you have a few minutes to spare.
Say, hey, like, how about we schedule just some us time Thursday, you know, after dinner? How does that sound for you? And if Thursday comes and you're not feeling it, that doesn't mean you actually have to have any type of like penetrative intercourse. You can make out and that can be connected. You can have a scalp rub and that can be connection. You can have a butt rub and that's connection too. Or you can just sit and watch whatever Netflix thing you want to. All of those things count as intimacy and bonding. It doesn't always have to be a pounding level of intercourse or sweat session to count.
Logan, I am totally asking for my newly divorced friends here. How does someone who got married, let's say in the pre or early dating app age, start dating at this moment?
Yes, I can definitely speak to that. I would also just love to comment on the intimacy question.
Please.
We did some really interesting research on this at Hinge. We did this in-depth project into what we called sexploration. What we found is that the pandemic had a clear impact on the sexual behavior of singles, and that a third of Hinge users told us that they're actually waiting longer to have sex with new partners because of fears of COVID. But in all of those months of being alone or waiting to have sex, they actually, as I said before, kind of went inside. And what that meant here was exploring fantasies, exploring kinks, watching new types of pornography. And so what we found is that people have these new sexual desires that they're looking to explore with a sexual partner. And so 80% of the people that we surveyed said that it was important to them that a partner be sexually open and adventurous. And so waiting longer to have sex, having sex with fewer people, but then being interested in exploring more adventurous sex because of that time spent alone developing those fantasies.
Interesting. And then regarding like somebody who's never used an app before, any advice for them?
Sure. The first thing I would tell your friend or anyone in that situation is just to be compassionate with themselves. This is a challenging time to date for certain people because it's 2 years into a pandemic. Any pool of resilience we have might have disappeared a long time ago. There are fears around how do I kiss somebody in a way that feels safe? What are the rules now? And so I would just tell that person if they're feeling like it's a challenge, that's a very common feeling. That being said, they can bring it up. In terms of general getting back out there tips, the first thing I would say is have a great profile. It sounds obvious, but people say, I'm going to sign up for Hinge today, and then they rush through the process. Your profile makes a huge difference to how many matches you get, how many dates you go on. So really making sure that your profile is this authentic, flattering, but accurate perception of you, that it's shows different sides of who you are, that it's a little serious and a little funny. I would spend a lot of time on that profile and then specifically going after what you want. So not just sending likes, but sending comments, being thoughtful and really showing the other person, hey, this is what I'm looking for. What are you looking for? And so that's one other trend of the pandemic dating that I'll bring up is something called hardballing. People are being more upfront earlier about what they're looking for because they think, I don't have any time to waste. So I'm looking for a long-term relationship. Is that what you're looking for? If not, this is probably not the date for us.
So Dr. Lex, if some folks don't want to use the apps, I actually heard from a friend today. He's been on the apps for years and he wants to take a break, but he still wants to meet somebody. Any tips on meeting somebody in real life, on finding a romantic partner outside of the apps?
Oh, absolutely. So what's really important is that people tend to be attracted to your confidence and when you're in your element. And so I love to tell people to start joining your interest groups, right? So we have all of these social media things. They have groups. There's meetup.com. There's Facebook groups. Maybe you're going to be in Plant Parents of Brooklyn, right? And you can meet people through these different types of groups that are local, that are going to have some interests that you share and are in common. Maybe you're a Trekkie and maybe first generation is your jam. And so you can find other people with like interest that are also closer to you, that you're already going to have some passions that are the same. You're already going to be somewhere with some similar knowledge and possibly similar locale. So start to look at what you're interested in and get involved there and build up your confidences, meet people. And then those people also know people. And so you automatically expand your network where it's like, hey, I've been talking to this friend online and they're actually single. You all might hit it off with my other friend. And you start to have people being able to do the work for you, which is really nice, by still feeding yourself and nourishing yourself and building your own confidence and building out those social networks.
My parents met at a Parents Without Partners meeting many years ago, almost 40 years ago. So that is great advice. Logan, looking forward to 2022, what kind of trends are you seeing on the dating apps? What do you envision? Anything that we should be expecting that might be a little bit different?
At Hinge, we're really expecting to see voice continue to be a huge part of the experience. We're always trying to think about how can we limit that space between looking at somebody's profile and understanding what it would be like to be with them. So right now, a lot of people say, I don't know how to assess chemistry on an app. I don't know what this person would be like in person. But listening to their voice is the first shift that we've made towards really limiting that gap. And so I'm going to be interested to see what else we can do to do that. From a psychological perspective, I've been talking to a lot of people about mental health and the fact that in the past, talking about going to therapy, talking about investing in your mental health might have been considered a stigma. Oh, is there something wrong with you? Oh, why is that something that you struggle with? And now it's really flipped. So we found that only 8% of Hinge users would say on a first date that they had been to therapy, but that 87% of people really want a partner who invests in mental health. And in fact, people told us that they're more likely to go on a second date with someone if they mention on the first date that they go to therapy. Wow. So we are now in a world where mental health and investing in it, whether it's through therapy or something else, is no longer just a nice to have. It can actually be considered a deal breaker for many people.
Wow, taking care of your mental health is sexy, Dr. Lax. How about that?
We've been booked and busy.
I believe it. Talk to us about teen and tween dating, Dr. Lax. What should parents with kids around that age know and be aware of?
Right. So being mindful that they don't have access to apps, right? And that teens and tweens oftentimes have been getting looked over. So we know about the mental health and their struggles with being in and out of school, the level of grief and loss they've had with school activities, especially our seniors and our graduating rising eighth graders to becoming high school freshmen. But also tween and teen relationship building is an integral part of their social development at these ages. And so what people like to term as like puppy love or new crushes, they tend to take them less seriously, but they're really serious. They're helping them model and learn and navigate consent and interest. But the pandemic has tended to cut that off for a lot of teens and tweens. So for parents and caregivers, it really would behoove getting to know that other family, possibly making a COVID pod to see if, hey, how do we get our teens and tweens able to get together safely to socialize? Do we have similar family values where everybody's going to be able to be safe in this atmosphere? And so they can spend some time together, whether you all want to make sure that you're going to be the parents right in the next room or the parents in the room next to them, however you want to make sure that they're safe is fine, but making sure they still have those outlets and those times to be with one another and grow socially and possibly romantically too.
Sure. All right, Logan, before I let you go, is there anything we haven't touched on that you want to leave us with?
Yes. So I am speaking to so many daters right now who feel really burned out, and we are at the end of the year and it's been a tough time. And so what I would say is look forward to Dating Sunday. Dating Sunday is the first Sunday of the year. And we find, probably because of New Year's resolutions and New Year, New You, that there's a huge influx of new daters. And so if you're feeling like you need to take a little break, I would give that to yourself over the holidays and then work on your profile and come back early January and really be ready. And so I think it's fine to take a break when you need it, but you should also have a deadline for when you're going to put yourself back out there. And 2022 can definitely be your year to find love.
Tremendous advice. Logan Urie is the author of the book, How to Not Die Alone, and director of relationship science at Hinge. Dr. Lex Brown James is a licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. Guys, it was so great to speak with you. I appreciate it. Best of luck in life and love in 2022.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Being a parent during this pandemic has been something. Virtual school and masks, explaining to a six-year-old why his birthday party can't happen, and trying to ignore the fact that the 10-year-old is on her 10th hour of screen time. Parenting is hard on a good day, and these are not good days.
Well, I may not have been a perfect mother, but you know, kids don't come with a handbook.
In fact, there are thousands of books written on child rearing.
I'll sometimes go to bed reading a parenting book which extols the virtues of keeping calm when disciplining, of modeling good behavior, of not getting triggered by tantrums, of showing empathy, not anger. And then I wake up, rush to get everyone out the door for the day, get increasingly stressed as somehow someone can't seem to brush their teeth or get their shoes on, or even after I've said it like 10 times already, and boom, I explode, I yell. And the thing is, yelling is like getting drunk. It feels great in the moment. It's a release. And then the hangover sets in. Immediate regret. And empty promises to never do that again. Why couldn't I handle this better? What happened to my patience? Parenting took my patience, and so did the pandemic. Given all of that, I was thrilled to listen to a new podcast from my friend and former colleague in the WNYC newsroom, Yasmeen Khan, that addresses exactly these parenting difficulties. It's called Childproof, and it comes from the meditation app 10% Happier. It's a podcast not about children, but about parents. Here's Yasmeen in the trailer.
It's Thursday. I am sitting down the hall from my kids who are yelling in the background. This is me, hiding from my family as my two daughters get ready for bed. The energy is a little crazy and I don't feel like dealing with it right now. Not trying to slack off or anything, but I hear my kid having a meltdown. And I don't want to have a meltdown either, because I feel like I could. Am I allowed to say that?
And so here to help us sort through parenting, especially right now in this moment, and maybe help us find a moment of calm, we're joined by Yasmeen Khan, host and managing editor of the podcast Childproof. Yas, how are you?
Hello, Matt. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, of course. I was so thrilled to listen to this. It really is, I'm hoping, going to help me find my zen as a parent in the coming months of Omicron. So tell me, like, why did you embark on this project? Why make a podcast specifically about parenting? What gap were you hoping to fill with this?
Yeah. Well, I was kind of giggling during your intro because you basically just summarized my experience and basically what the show is about so perfectly. I mean, you know, 10% Happier, which is the company I work for now. I work for a mindfulness and meditation company, by the way, was exploring this issue of parenting and parent stress and anxiety. And they talked to me about coming on and kind of leading this ride with parents, because I had the same issues, have the same issues as you and so many other parents out there. I mean, not getting triggered by a tantrum. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Like, we are wired to respond to crying and to be stressed. And I didn't know how to do that. And lots of things that our kids do may trigger us, but also, like, we have jobs, we have stress, we have family stress, you know, right. You know, extended families or stress or something like that. So there are all these things that we as adults, parents have to manage. And, you know, for me, I was at this time last year, you know, I was a reporter in a newsroom, really stressed at work, stressed having kids at home from school. And just like that combination of anxiety and exhaustion was making me really shouty. Yeah. I was like shouting at my children or snapping at them or snapping at my husband. And I felt overrun by stress and my emotions. And I didn't like that about myself. It wasn't good for my relationship with my kids, but I didn't like that about myself. And yeah. I knew that it didn't have to be that way. And that's when I started to kind of dabble in meditation and learning about mindfulness practices, because I was like, I have to interrupt this cycle somehow. So that's what, you know, the show is kind of mindfulness adjacent. Like, we're going to talk about strategies of how to deal with the getting calm, like getting to the point of getting calm and like actually being able to do the things we need to do to prevent being triggered or know what our triggers are. Mm-hmm. But really, I want to be able to take stock of how I'm doing as a parent. I want to be able to sort of know how I've changed. I want to be able to I want to change. I want to grow. And I want to know how to do that. And I also just want to hear how other parents are doing. And we're going to sort of tell those stories and bring people together so that we don't have to feel so alone.
In the first episode, you talk to parents about how parenting has changed them. And you're also quite vulnerable, as we heard in that clip, and airing mm-hmm. your own reality as a parent. So tell us a little bit about your parenting journey. Have you learned in going through this process how being a parent has changed you?
I think I'm still thinking about that question. I mean, I know that I've changed. It's sort of hard to pull apart whether it's just because I've grown in my career or because I've had two kids or because I've been married for 10 years or I live in New York. And I still am not sure why sometimes, you know, like all these things happen in our lives, right? That change us. I will say that for me, I knew that when I became a parent, it kind of felt to me like this opportunity to change in ways that I wanted to. I remember thinking that when my first daughter was born. I'm not sure that I have totally lived up to the changes that I wanted to make for myself. I'm talking about things like regulating my emotions. Like I've always been someone who's been emotional. I have big feelings and I show them. And I think that's a great thing about me, but I also have always wanted to be able to be in charge of them more. Mm-hmm. And I felt like parenting was maybe an opportunity for me to do that. Maybe, which is funny to say, because there's so many challenges to regulating your emotions when you're a parent. So I'm going to say, like, to answer that question, I'm going to say that I'm not entirely sure yet how I've changed, but I know that there are ways that I want to. And parenting has made that clear to me.
In terms of being in charge of those emotions, you know, those moments when we feel out of control, when the stresses of parenting combined with just life merge into this mess of yelling in the house at bedtime or at breakfast time, and whether it's related to the pandemic or just whatever's happening in that situation at that time. What do the meditation experts that you've been speaking with say we're supposed to do in those moments?
I mean, many things. So I'm about to say things that you know and that are like so intuitive sounding, but I will say one, breathing.
Right.
Like, and I seriously, since I've started this as a more of a practice, I breathe more deeply now throughout the day. And for instance, when I know that I might get a little shouty at bedtime or I'm just really tired at the end of the day, I will take many deep breaths before I go upstairs and start the process of trying to get my kids in pajamas and brushing teeth. That helps. And just things like kind of recognizing, like we said, recognizing triggers. So for me, it might be like my kid is throwing a tantrum. So how do I make sure that I am not also going to lose it right now? Or maybe I will. Or it's just that I know that this particular time of day, bedtime, by the way, this is what our second episode focuses on, is my bedtime problem.
Wow.
Is just knowing that that time of day is hard for me and just recognizing that for myself.
Right.
It's not rocket science. I'm not even doing anything other than maybe interrupting this cycle of like getting angry, feeling terrible about it, feeling ashamed of myself as a parent. If I could just like recognize that, okay, this is hard, or I don't like this part of parenting.
And that's
like
okay.
It's okay. It's okay. Like it just, that helps. I will say that, you know, for on our show too, there are a lot of things we want to talk about. And I don't want to make it sound like we're going to be talking about all these negative things that are so hard and it's all about struggle,
okay,
which it is. It's all challenging. I mean, but parenting obviously is really fun and it can be super joyful and hilarious and we can have a good time, but we also need to talk about our friendships and how our friendships have changed. Mm. And we're going to do that. We're going to talk about how we can build community in like really meaningful ways so that we can actually ask for help or accept it when it's offered to us. And that is part of, you know, even though this is about like how we live in the world, this is relates to our internal experience as parents, because we need other people to have our backs. And it feels good, too, to offer help to another parent that may need it.
I love that. Yasmin Khan is the host and managing editor of the podcast Childproof from 10% Happier. Get Childproof wherever you get your podcasts. Yasmin, thank you for bringing us some balance and for bringing us this podcast. So appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, listeners, it's your turn. You've been talking to us about your relationships. Here's what you had to say.
My name is Jonna Gibbs. The most challenging thing for me as a parent during the COVID pandemic was I have a teenager who started high school, and everything, of course, is on the Chromebook. Everything is electronic. But unlike most parents, I still had to go to work every day. So I had to trust my teenager to log in and actually be present. And some days he would, some days he wouldn't. I mean, some days he just decided, you know what, I'm not doing this. And it wasn't like I could stay there and make sure that he logged in.
This is Julian from Las Vegas, Nevada. The most difficult thing with this pandemic and parenting is being a teacher myself and having students, and then trying to find a way to get them to learn and to be there for my students. And not all schools at all times are willing to understand the degree of flexibility needed by someone doing that double duty.
Without a doubt, the hardest thing I've ever experienced is the social and mental toll these years have taken on my teenagers. I can't place my finger on what it is, but the teenagers in my life, from work to home and friends of my kids, have all suffered in their mental and social health at some level in the wake of the pandemic. The continued stressors and social disconnect will, I believe, be a defining moment for this generation.
My name is Mary Poole. I'm calling from Safety Harbor, Florida. When COVID first hit in March of 2020, we sequestered down very firmly in my multi-generational home. My daughter has MS and had just had chemo and had no immunities. I'm 75 and I have three teenagers. So we all homeschooled and didn't allow anyone in. The first couple of weeks, one of my 17-year-old grandson's friends came into the house without questioning, and I didn't know she was there with two of her friends. And I freaked out and I told them they had to leave. And I hurt their feelings because it just happened to be one of the girls' birthdays, and I felt terrible about it. But I've had to keep a tight circle on my teenagers and our family to protect us, particularly before vaccination.
The biggest problem with the COVID pandemic has been the parenting at home for children with regards to the initial closure when COVID first started, and then the subsequent closures and quarantining for students with close contact. Parents are not equipped for educating their kids, and then I believe schools have struggled with providing the necessary information in order for parents to educate their kids at home. And then not to mention the spotty Wi-Fi for northern Wisconsin has also been an issue.
Hi, this is Nikki. I'm calling from Arlington, Texas. The single most difficult or challenging parenting moment that I have had throughout this entire COVID thing has been repeating myself to my teens and 20-somethings. No, you cannot go to the party. No, you cannot go work out with your friends in a crowded gym. No, you cannot hang out in a restaurant with all your friends when it's overpopulated and overcrowded, because IHOP or Waffle House or any of those diner places are always packed to the gills when all of the bars close at night.
This is James from Bellevue. The most difficult parenting experience I had during COVID was trying to coordinate visitation with my child out of town when my current wife doesn't want to have any people visiting our household.
Hi, everybody. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. And one way or another, this takeaway is going to end.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
And so began the blockbuster known as The Matrix back in 1999. I cannot believe this film was made more than 20 years ago. Today marks the theatrical debut of the fourth installment in the Matrix franchise, The Matrix Resurrections.
The only thing that matters to you is still here. I know it's why you're still fighting and why you will never give up.
You don't know me.
No?
That's just a little taste of what audiences can expect in the new film, which is getting mixed reviews. Yet the movie still has the potential to be a blockbuster and groundbreaking at the same time, as it's directed by Lana Wachowski, making this perhaps the biggest blockbuster film ever helmed by a trans person. For more on the new film and the Matrix series, I spoke with Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. I asked her, how did the original film become a lasting cultural phenomenon?
Every so often, there's a movie that sort of comes along and changes everything. And The Matrix is probably the most influential movie since Star Wars. Wow. There's a number of reasons for this, but I think the primary one is that it just looks cool. Like, I don't know how to quantify that, but like, if you watch this movie, even today in 2021, 22 years after it was released, you're like, yeah, that looks really cool. I do think that one of the big reasons that it has managed to have that lasting impact, however, even though literally every movie in Hollywood has borrowed some element of this movie's style, I think that impact comes from the fact that its underlying story is sort of about how what we think of as reality is not real, and what we think of as our mission in life is maybe misguided. And it is this all-purpose metaphor that can speak to a number of things in life that has gained resonance as we've gotten further into the 21st century. And people have sort of said, wait a second, a lot of these goals and things that I was taught to wish for as a child are maybe not panning out in the way I thought. Let's see if there are other things I could be looking for. Mm. The Matrix is about that. And it kind of got ahead of the curve in that regard. And I think that's really amazing.
Yeah. Is it like more relevant now to a viewer? I mean, in watching it now, does it almost make more sense than it did in 1999?
In some ways, yes. But I do think one of the things that's fascinating about this movie, and I wrote about this for Vox, there are sort of five eras that overlap roughly, but we keep reinterpreting The Matrix and it keeps standing up to that reinterpretation. Like, I end the piece with a joke about how 30 years from now, maybe our robot oppressors will view this movie through a new light. And I really think it's true that this movie does have this element to it that makes it capable of being reinterpreted multiple ways. And I think that will just keep going.
Okay, so we're now at the fourth film.
Yes.
Have you seen it? What can we expect? No spoilers, or maybe not too many spoilers.
I love the fourth movie. It has proved hugely divisive, which of course all of the Matrix sequels have proved hugely divisive. Just to run down my love, I love movie two. I think movie three is comparatively weak. I think movie four is great. It's hard to talk about this movie without spoilers because, like, literally the premise of the movie is kind of a spoiler. Huh. But I will say that it is very much engaged in a conversation with the idea of franchise filmmaking, with the idea that everything now has to be part of a franchise and that our beloved characters can never be let to rest. And I have a piece on this coming up at Vox, but I think there are a number of movies that have sort of tried to engage with this idea, but nobody has gone all in the way that Lana Wachowski and her team have on this movie. And also, without spoiling, it's a big old love story. It is a Titanic-style love story, and I am overwhelmed by that. Like, there was a moment in this movie that made me cry. I don't know if you'd expect that from a Matrix movie.
Wow. But there are detractors, I guess, online. Some people are not feeling this. Is there a particular reason?
Yeah, I mean, like all Wachowski movies, there is a lot of big-hearted sincerity in this, and that is not for everyone. But I also think there is kind of a reaction to the fact that this movie is saying franchise filmmaking, which is the core of the industry right now, is maybe kind of creatively bankrupt. And if you want to do a movie like that, you should figure out a new thing to do with these characters. You know, I don't think that's going to work for everybody. It really worked for me as a big Matrix fan. It's really worked for a bunch of other Matrix fans I know. But I do understand why it wouldn't work for some people. The Wachowskis are just really divisive filmmakers. I love them, but not everybody does.
So they were actually supposed to be done with the Matrix.
Yes.
What happened? How did this latest installment come about?
I just want to clarify really quickly, because I keep using Wachowskis and Wachowski interchangeably. Lily Wachowski was involved in the first three Matrix movies. She still has a credit for having created the characters on this movie. She is not involved in movie four. She's off making the wonderful Showtime series Work in Progress, which I highly recommend to everybody.
Okay.
Lana Wachowski made this movie as a solo director. It is her first solo director credited film. It is this situation where if you read interviews with the various people who are involved in the movie, it sounds like Warner Brothers came to the Wachowskis a lot of times between the release of movie three in 2003 and right now and said, hey, can you make us a fourth movie? And they would say, no, no, no. And Lana Wachowski said in a speech at the Berlin Film Festival that she was dealing with the death of both of her parents and the death of a very dear friend that happened really closely to each other in 2019. And she suddenly woke up and was like, had this notion for a new story about Neo and Trinity. And she said she found that very comforting to have these old friends, these old fictional friends come back to sort of have a new adventure at a time when she couldn't have that with these people that she really loved. And I find that very touching, and it really does reflect throughout the film. But it, you know, in terms of Warner Brothers, they've just always wanted a Matrix movie.
Of course.
So yeah.
Well, I'm glad they found a reason to make this out of love and beauty as opposed to just, you know, cash.
Yeah.
You've written about the Matrix as a trans allegory for the experiences, yes, of Lily and Lana Wachowski. Can you explain that a little bit?
So I think one of the things that is notable about that first film, as mentioned earlier, is it really is interested in exploring the idea that reality is an illusion, that we live in sort of a simulation. And that is a metaphor that works for a lot of people on a lot of different levels. And I think that one level it really works on is as an exploration of gender. There is this element of the film that replicates the experience of being what we in the trans community sometimes call an egg, which is a pre-transition trans person who has yet to come out to themselves and is sort of safely cocooned in an area where they're not really like experiencing the world as strongly as they could be, because gender dysphoria kind of dissociates your brain just a little bit. Not so much that you can't deal with the world, but enough that you are very disconnected and detached from the world. And then you take a pill and suddenly your brain starts to come back online. And in the 90s, estrogen pills were red, and like the red pill could be a reference to estrogen. I think this is a stretch. Both of the Wachowskis were not out in 1999. So far as we know, they were not out to themselves, but it is kind of a cool coincidence. And if you look at the movie through that lens, you know, there's a bunch of scenes of, for instance, the climax of the movie involves Agent Smith essentially dead naming Neo. There are things about characters, you know, having sort of different cooler appearances in the Matrix versus in reality. There's a scene where Neo finds Trinity and says he thought she was a guy, and she said most guys do. Like, there's just all kinds of elements that add up to that. I always stop at calling it an allegory because I think there are so many different ways to read this movie. And I don't want to take away from someone who reads this as, for instance, a leftist film, because I think it is that. But I do think there are a lot of trans themes in this movie, whether the Wachowskis intended them or not. And I think that's why it speaks so much to trans people.
And the Wachowski sisters came out as trans women in more recent years after.
Yes. In the 2010s, though, from what we know, Lana Wachowski seems like she was out to friends and family somewhere in the 2000s. There were rumors about her in around the release of The Matrix Reloaded in 2003, which is the second film. And if you go back and look at those rumors, you see why she doesn't really like talking to press now. They're really nasty. And it's a reminder of how transphobic, even fairly mainstream media outlets could be in 2003.
You referenced The Matrix as an allegory for the left and as a leftist set of films. Yeah. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because like red pilling was adopted by the alt-right, of course. But
Yes. And I think, again, one of the strengths of this is that you can interpret this movie in a whole bunch of different ways. And I'm sure we'll talk about red pilling in a second. But I do think that the core of these movies is kind of about a whole bunch of people of various races, of various genders, of various like political ideals coming together to build a better world. And ultimately, The Matrix is kind of a metaphor for capitalism. It's about the idea that you are being placated by this notion of if you have enough stuff, if you have a good enough job, if you have enough money, you are going to be secure. And that sort of marriage of capitalism and commercialism that drives so much of our thinking in modern life, even without us, you know, really considering it, is at the core of what The Matrix is. And it's how the systems of oppression literally keep you placated and in a slumber and hallucinating a reality that's better than it actually is. And I do think that that critique was taken in a different way in 1999 when the US economy was pretty good for many people. And now in an era of income inequality, I think it's easier to read that into the film. Again, this gets interpreted and reinterpreted. Sure. But the Wachowskis themselves are pretty old school leftists. If you go and look around the time that Trump was first in office, you can find quotes from Lana Wachowski, who was at various protests and sort of gave very leftist answers to the questions that she was asked. And there is this element of, you know, if you look at these movies, you can see them almost as a sci-fi adaptation of Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent. Like you have to take a couple leaps, but you can get there. So I think reading these movies as leftist films is really a rich reading of them. I think it isn't closer to whatever the Wachowskis' intent was. And I think authorial intent ultimately doesn't matter in our reading of a film. But I think it's an interesting way to read them. And I think it kind of cuts against, again, the red pill reading.
Right, right. And do you want to explain a little bit about that, the red pill reading by the alt-right?
Yeah. So there's this thing called the Manosphere online, which is a number of disgruntled men who, in essence, have deeply misogynist ideas about what women's place in society and in relation to them should be. And there are a whole bunch of different things that sort of lump into the Manosphere and various Venn diagram intersections. For instance, you might have heard about incels, and there's a heavy Venn diagram intersection there. But the red pill is one of the core metaphors of the Manosphere. And the idea behind the red pill is that if you, again, take the red pill, your eyes will be open to what reality is. And in this case, it's in essence kind of what now we might call anti-woke settlement. It is very much the idea that, like, if you take the red pill, you'll see the way that society is being biased against men or against white men. And you can drill down as specifically as you want to get in terms of like who various people in this group are against. But it is, again, this all such a strong all-purpose metaphor for having your eyes open to reality. And like, I don't agree with that reading of the film. I don't think it's an intended reading of the film. I think it's a reading of the film that has done active harm in the world. But I also don't think it's an invalid reading of the film. I think you can watch this movie and find that in there. And like, yeah, it's you know, I don't think it jibes with a movie that is about a multiracial coalition of people teaming together to bring down capitalism, but it's not there. And I think that that's fascinating.
I think it's fascinating as well. How important is it, do you think, for the trans community that this new film has the potential to be a blockbuster directed by the first openly trans filmmaker?
You know, I think that the fact that the Wachowskis keep making huge movies and keep having, in a way, a blank check for what they want to do, and that's gotten less true over the years as more of their movies have bombed, it is an important thing to the trans community, to trans people in general, to me specifically. Like, it is wonderful that the most influential movie since Star Wars was directed by two trans women. There is just this element of, oh, you might not understand trans identities, but you probably understand the Matrix. And if you can understand the Matrix as a metaphor for what trans people go through, for what trans people have to deal with, then that's maybe a way to start having conversations with your trans friends. But also, like, it's just kind of cool that in an industry that is still heavily dominated by straight cis white men, there are these two trans women who made a huge hit in 1999 and now continue to get chances to make movies. And The Matrix Resurrections, whatever you want to say about it after seeing it, it is not a dull retread of their work. It is very much Lana Wachowski saying, I want to do new things with these characters and you can join me or not. And it is, again, you know, there's a lot of elements in it that I think trans people will find very interesting and thoughtful, especially in terms of the movie is thematically about all of the ways in which binaries that we are set up with, you know, good and evil as in the obvious one, but so is male and female, are, you know, ultimately more like spectrums. And yeah, if you're able to free yourself from that binary thinking, there's a much bigger and more exciting world out there for you. And to say more about that theme would be to spoil some pretty big things in the movie. Right. But yeah.
We'll leave it there. I cannot wait to see this film. It was so fascinating to chat with you. Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Thanks so much for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
Okay, folks, that's the show. Appreciate you tuning in. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. It's available wherever you get your audio or head over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, call us with your show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.